Hi, I'm Lee Rail and you're listening to SeedPod, a podcast dedicated to the people shaping South Africa through entrepreneurship, sustainability and design. Before we get started, please rate us on iTunes and share this with your friends. It really helps us a lot. This week's podcast is the next in the series that was recorded at the FoodNext conference at the CTICC in September 2019. This week's guest, Siphamandla Makela, is a 28-year-old entrepreneur breaking fresh ground in the realm of agro-processing with her business Local Village. She produces a variety of artisanal and organic foods and has built a compelling value proposition with a niche health market. Makela's business has been running for 3 years and has already proven itself a valuable and viable startup, providing employment and community growth. Siphamandla has been named one of South Africa's top 200 young people to watch by Mail and Guardian. She's inspired by the South African continent, its diverse cultures, and is on a quest for social and economic unity, and wants to play a role in the implementation of free and fair trade across Africa. I was truly inspired by the powerful presence that Siphamandla carries and the strong leadership values that she exudes. I feel privileged to have had the opportunity to sit down with such a powerful young black woman and hear the way that she thinks. Our conversation spanned many topics, from gender parity to the lack of leadership in South Africa to xenophobia and her views on some of the racial issues we face in our country. Siphamandla has a refreshingly clear voice and is a true future leader of our country. Enjoy. Afternoon, Siphamandla. Thanks for joining me here. We're at the CTICC for the FoodNext conversation. I missed your talk today, so I regrettably, but I'll get a one-on-one, so I'm lucky, I guess.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Pleasure. So you're from the big smoke, the Joburg. Do you come down here often? Are you...
Now and again. I've got a contract packer here, so I do sort of work establishing a new sort of partner for the business. And so I find that one often comes now and again to Cape Town. Joburg is just where I reside, a place that I've, city that I've come to love, but I'm a rural girl from Lusikisiki.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where in South Africa is that? I don't know.
So Lusikisiki is on the Wild Coast.
Right.
The former Transkei area.
I love that place. I love the Wild Coast. It is my favorite part of South Africa, without a doubt.
Yeah. So I'm from that part.
Okay. Where about along the coast is it? Mthatha, Port St. John's, where, like north or south? Or?
So I'm like 30 minutes away from Port St. John's, as if you were driving towards like Flex of Bizana towards KZN.
Okay.
So
it's north. Right. Okay. It's a very special, I don't know how you feel about it, because it's contentious as well. But, you know, I didn't intend on having a political conversation here, but, you know, it was an apartheid construction.
Yeah. I mean, Lusikisiki is one of us saying earlier today in my talk that, I mean, just the importance of actually highlighting that I'm from Lusikisiki and the work that I do as a business. I find that Lusikisiki is one of the towns that are, if you were adding 1 + 1, obviously you'd come up with 2. So surely it should be a town that is sort of thriving from an economy point of view, but it's one of the most poorest towns in the country. High unemployment, high teenage pregnancy, level of education as well. Yet we've got such great climate, we've got good land, and we've got people. So surely a town like that should be able to thrive, but we don't see that. But they are trying to improve it now. Sandral is building into extension there, so let's see.
Is that's not the I know for a while there was a mining company was trying to build a mine on the coast. Is that going ahead?
I don't know where the debate is right now. So that's not in the Lusikisiki particular area.
Right.
Is that the Australian?
Yes.
Okay. So that's more towards, I think, Bizana side.
Okay.
So I don't know, because I think communities were involved and I think it's still on hold.
Okay.
Actually, communities came out and it seemed, you know, this project might not continue. I don't know if they want to pay. Hopefully not.
Yeah. Okay. So the N2's being extended, you say?
Yeah, from R61. I think that's called R61. So they're sort of constructing now. They're sort of building. I'm hoping that will be able to bring in business and hopefully stir up some economic activity in that area, so that at least it may contribute to sort of job creation. And, yeah.
I'd imagine a lot of young people leave that area to seek greater fortunes and wealth and jobs and anything, move to the cities and...
No, correct. I mean, there are quite a lot of other young people that are still in Lusikisiki. There are some of them are professionals. I've got a friend, she's a teacher. She went to university and then worked somewhere in KZN. Now she's back in Lusikisiki. So I think she likes it. But some of us, most sort of when we attended school, did boarding school. So the closest city is Durban. So most of us went to KZN and studied there, and you go back or you decide to settle in KZN or you find an employment elsewhere. So a lot of people do, specifically if you've got parents maybe who perhaps want something better than what Lusikisiki education can offer. So they take you to boarding school or to their relatives in other provinces that you can.
So you did you go to boarding school?
I did.
In KZN, in Durban?
Yeah. So before Durban, I did Mthwalume. So it's still on the wild coast, next to Torty side. It was in the sugar canes.
Okay.
So it wasn't the most sort of high-end boarding schools, but it sort of taught me structure and sort of understanding how to and be in a community with other young people. So I did that. And then I moved to Durban. I studied there for about 2 years and I stayed in a boarding house there. Then I moved to Queenstown in the Eastern Cape for about 3 years. And then I went back to Durban for about 4 years at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And then I moved up to Joburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And now you're an entrepreneur. What Correct. Did you study? What did you?
So I did a social science degree, majored in business and community development. So I think it was obviously inspired by my upbringing. So my mom is in business and she... Her business way of doing business has always been having the community at the core of everything. So coming from Lusikisiki, from a community like that, where, you know, surely it should make sense. The community should thrive because of all the resources that it has, natural resources. So I didn't understand what is it that's holding us back. So I wanted to understand how do we develop communities, but also the passion for business for me was there. I started my first company in grade 11, a toilet paper manufacturing company. I was 17 and my mom inspired me to do that. And it was formal, registered with CICP and everything. And so I started marketing to the hospitals, but then I went to matric and my business partner got a job because he was more on the technical side. My mom introduced me to the business partner. And so the business really didn't really take off as ideally I would have wanted it to. So then I did a degree and then I did corporate a bit for 18 months and then went back to the pursuit of entrepreneurship. But my background and my study obviously playing such a role in terms of our business model and what we do as a business. Yeah.
Mm. And your dad, what did he do?
So he was, you know, in the rural areas, you never really know what your dad does most of the time. Unless you come from a middle class family, you see him wear a suit and he goes, I think he worked with some project. They were paying grants to people that go out into communities and pay grants, but he's late now. So that was sort of years ago. And
okay.
Yeah,
that's just interesting. I mean, so you were closer to your mom?
Yeah, I was. Okay. I was. My dad passed away when I was a very young girl. And my mom, though, she's been really inspiring and very instrumental in terms of my framework and how I actually do things and a value system and drilling that in and ensuring that, you know, she creates an environment that we, you know, can be the best that we've been created to be.
Do you have siblings as well? Is it a big family? Or
I do. So it's interesting. So my mom and my dad, was married to somebody else.
So is mine, don't worry.
So I've got siblings for my father's and his marriage side, and then I've got siblings for my mom in her first marriage.
Okay.
So it's like mixed. But I think in our culture, so every sibling, we just grow up, and that's just that we don't have half sisters and half brothers,
right?
In a sense.
It's just brothers and sisters.
That's it. Yeah. So okay. I do.
Okay. And are they also involved in the community, or have they all moved out? Are they?
Yeah, no, most. I mean, they've moved out. Some are professionals in various towns and cities doing different things. But I don't, there's nobody who's located at home and that sort of stuff. Yeah. So my mom lives alone and running her business. She's 70 years old and is running
Amazing.
Her business. Yeah.
The African women of this country, they carry this country, I think, in so many ways. In the cities, a lot of them are employed in the more affluent homes, looking after the kids and looking after their own kids and often earning financially to run the homes. they carry a huge burden, I think.
I think things are starting to be sort of easier with education and more policies that are enabling that. But most South African children, specifically in the rural and the communities, either their fathers left some to come to the mines. And so you had families where it was the mom who's full time and trying to raise children and finding some work to do and to be able to provide for the family. Or sometimes fathers just, you know, are not present. So you find those sort of dynamics.
Yeah.
But I see now in society, obviously through policy and enabling women to sort of get into the space, work, but also get fair pay. It's still not there yet, but I think we are in pursuit of that as a society. So to sort of enable us, I find for me, I'm 28 years old and I found that sort of operating in the entrepreneurship space, of course there are a few difficulties, but I find that I don't have much discrimination because I'm an African woman, for instance, in the space that I'm in. So it's either you've got a good product or you don't have a good product. But it's a few people who sort of find that, you know, as a woman, they're going to make it sort of difficult for you to operate. But I find that people are sort of opening up and more women are getting into the space. And yeah.
Mm, that's good to hear because it needs to shift globally. It's not just here.
Yeah.
I surf and I follow surfing quite a lot. And surfing is, to my knowledge, the only sport in the world where men and women get equal prize money.
Wow.
Still today.
Wow. Yeah, I heard, I don't know if it's true, but I heard about whether it was Banyana or just the salaries the soccer player, the females were actually getting in comparison to the male counterpart. But I think for me that's so unjust, you know. That's really unjust.
Yeah, it is. And it's just a historical legacy that we are still living with. The patriarchal society.
No, correct. Yeah, you're just reminding me. I remember just following the Hillary campaign and Donald Trump and everything before elections. And they went to some community. I don't remember what community it was. And they asked this one older woman, so are you going to vote for Hillary? She says, women are not supposed to be presidents. She will never be able to vote for women because women are so emotional and they won't be able to get the job done. I laughed and I thought, this is a woman, this is not a man. And how do you debate something like that when it actually comes from a woman? And so things like that actually hold back. So sort of America is very modernized and perceived to be very modernized and developed.
Mm.
Yet, you know, they don't have a female president. We've had Malawi, for instance, where they've had a female entrepreneur, but it's in Africa in a sense. So, you know, it makes you wonder.
I think America, as you say, it's perceived that they're modern, but in many ways the proof that Donald Trump's their president proves that they're not as modern as they think they are.
Yeah.
Or he's just manipulated the system really well, which I think is the case as
But I mean, but you still see people sort of coming out and supporting his views. Some people don't believe that we are equally created and that sort of stuff, men, women, black and white. So people really do believe that and they've been raised to think like that. And so, unfortunately, that will come out in the way they vote and some of the policies they favor. And so, I find that it will take some time to sort of educate. But there's people like you, I suppose, you've got kids, so you have that opportunity to educate your children and what is right and what is wrong and what.
I've got two girls as well.
Ah, even better.
Yeah, I try to tell them that. That they're better than men in some ways, you know. And it's very prevalent now in the news and what's going on here in South Africa with the violence against women and it's so sad. It really is so sad.
It is. I mean, the day where I think it was the day before the protest here in Cape Town, I was in Malawi and just. In migration, like at the airport, so going through, and one security guy, South African, looks at me very lustful, and it just sort of scared me. And he says to me, "Can't I come with you?" And I just thought, how insensitive! Mm. How insensitive at such a time in our nation. Probably doesn't even know what's going on, or he chooses to ignore, but choose to say something like that to a stranger. So there's so much work that's still needed to be done in our country, in our nation. Around just justice, around rights, and
And as an entrepreneur now, you're a leader, whether you like it or not, whether you chose leadership or not, and a role model for many of these young girls and people in our society.
Yeah.
Do you feel the weight of that responsibility?
Yeah, look, I think when much has been given to you, much is required, I think, from each and every one of us. And so if you have people working for you, people supplying you, people looking up to you, inviting you to come speak at the events, schools and that sort of stuff. So I think it's important to really just, I don't know, to live what you say, firstly, to be, if you're talking about inspiration or you're talking about hard work, to be exactly that. So it is quite a lot of pressure, but it's something that's rewarding when you actually get to see some of the results and where people come up to you to say, you know, the way you do this really has shaped my thinking in this way. I used to think of this way, but I think these are priorities. These are the things I should focus on as a young woman, for instance. So I find that sometimes, I mean, even not intending to sort of play a role in anybody's life, but somebody coming to give you that feedback just by watching how you live, I think that's very important. So leadership for anyone, men and women, I think it's important for us to be really consistent, but to really understand that we are inspiration, whether we like it or not. And people look up to us, whether it's something good or bad.
Mm.
So people do look and watch our lives, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, but it's a gap, I think, in the world is real role models and real leadership.
Mm.
And you know, so seeing young people like you stepping in to the world, it's encouraging.
Yeah.
I can just feel the way you are and the openness and your smile and your energy. I can just... I'm excited to see where you go.
But it is, I mean, in the world, in terms of leadership, there is a huge gap. I was chatting to one mentor of mine. He's in strategy in one of the beverages company. So I said to him, I said, you know, we've got every tool in Africa to be successful. Africa has so much potential. So we've got all the resources in place to succeed as a continent. But what's the issue? What is it? And he said, you know, there's just one missing ingredient, just one ingredient, and we will thrive as a continent. It's leadership.
Mm.
It's across, not just in South Africa, but across. So if we could fix that in our society, starting at schools and how we train children, about a month ago, my husband and I, we sort of riding on an Uber, and the Uber driver is making like a U-turn, and then I see a school transport taking schools to a nearby school. And so the drivers are arguing on who's wrong, and, you know, because one wants to push, one is doing a U-turn. And the driver for the school transport starts swearing, and the kids in the transport start swearing at the Uber driver, swearing. And I thought, what is going on in our society? What are parents teaching children? So I think things like those are very important for us to be intentional about contributing in terms of development. So speaking leadership and being role models as parents, as team leaders, as employers, to be able to do that. And I think it will eventually hopefully lead to, even when we select the leadership we vote for, the people who, you know, are appointed as well as officials, that's quite an important,
I agree 100%. I think education plays a huge role in that though.
Correct.
Because if someone's not educated to the level where they understand what we're talking about here, then their decisions are based on a different set of rules.
But you know what? I think, I don't know. I don't even know it's about education. I mean, most of us, our parents didn't go to university. Some parents didn't even go to school, but they've taught you, you know, you've been taught as a child what is right and what is wrong and how to honor people and you know, values in place. So I don't think that would be sort of a right excuse, because then we'll say to people, you freely, because you didn't go to school, then you can behave in whatever way. So I feel like, it's just a matter of just a value system. Then that's important. That's what we need to bring back in our society, sort of losing values. I mean, we don't have, I find, some of the things we allow to happen in our country, things that are going on, people killing other people and looting from their stores. That shows a society where it doesn't even have values. And I suppose that's probably lack of leadership and just emphasizing the importance of the soul of a nation, the soul of a community. And once you start losing that, then, you know, I don't see much of a hope in a society like that. Yeah.
Mm. Do you feel hopeful for our society?
To be honest, I mean, I really don't know. I'm a business, I'm obviously in the Pan-African space, and And I, when I was in Malawi, I mean, that was for me a really good experience, just to see how, you know, people value each other and how communities work with each other and the spirit of Ubuntu. And, you know, you're going into a place where you've not met, and specifically what was going on in South Africa, and people treating you well from the airport and inviting you into their homes for a meal, greeting you on the road. South Africa, you get into a lift, people on their phone, nobody greets anybody. And I find that's not good for any community. So basic things like those, like greeting and honoring and respecting and making way for elders to pass and, you know, and being patient, being kind and gracious towards each other. If we don't have that and it's sort of goes away, then, you know, your society, you have to really check. That's obviously from more values point of view. But if you as a country decide to, say things to people about certain nations, and certain nations sort of close themselves in. I will sort of say, we're not going to entertain South Africa. We're not going to participate in a match like Morocco, I think Zambia as well, to say we're not going to have your national team on board. I think that's a tricky space to be in as a country, especially while we've just signed the free trade agreement, for instance, in the continent that takes effect next year. And that would mean great opportunities for business in South Africa, meaning growth, meaning employment. But now when countries don't want to interact with us, when there's going to be that free trade and stuff like that, then it raises the question, are we going to be successful? Are we going down? Or is there a way to turn around? Mm-hmm. Things are, you know.
Yeah. You need to fill me in, because I don't read newspapers and I have a very narrow stream of news. Why are Morocco and
it's because
other countries not playing soccer against us? What is the... What is happening? You tell me.
So in Johannesburg currently, and this is probably the third time it's happening post 1994.
Xenophobia.
Xenophobia. So people are saying, oh yeah, we're against Nigeria and the criminals and the drugs. But you find, you hear people's conversations and comments on social media that people are actually, there's sort of like a hatred towards other people who are different from their cultures and their tribes. You find people pushing back and saying, yeah, foreigners, and putting statements like, yeah, I know these people. And I find that's not good. Mm. I mean, if you were in another land, imagine people saying to you, oh, these people. And that's not good. A lot of people, some people have been in South Africa for about 40 years, and this is home to them. They contribute to the skill set of this country. They've brought skills that we didn't have. And then we call them these people. And we want them out of our country because they're taking our jobs. I mean, that's just nonsense at all levels. And so if you behave like that as a society, people are not going to want to play with you, for lack of a better word. They're not going to want to do any partnership with you. They're not going to want your businesses in their country. And obviously, as a country, we under pressure grow our GDP and create employment. And companies like ShopRite, for instance, that are operating in some of these countries, might take a knot in their South African base. What happens when they start retrenching people in South Africa because they're not doing well in the other markets, because nobody wants to buy their stores because of the behavior in this country? So we're not thinking about things like that. So I don't know, but I am hopeful. If leadership acts up, but if things remain as they are, I don't know what the future of South Africa is. I was telling my husband that I think I want to buy a house in Malawi. He was saying he's studying in Europe right now. He says probably we need to find a city in Europe that we can we sort of can stay.
Is he South African?
My husband is South African. Okay. Yeah, he's just studying in Europe. So having conversations like those are not really that great. It's good to say, okay, we'll choose to go there because we want to, not because, okay, do we see a
running
future?
Away versus yeah, going to, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. I know, and it's, I thought it was just a white conversation, but it's a middle-class conversation of where's this place going? Do we stay? Do we go? What's the future like? Mm. And it's... You also can't live one foot in, one foot out.
No, correct. Because the reality is, I mean, we're all South Africans and black and white. This is our country. And we have to roll up our sleeve and work if we want to make it work. Running away is almost like, it's like a shortcut in a sense. Like, you know what, it's safer, I can do it. I've got a qualification, I can go work internationally. And that's great, you can do that. But we are South Africans at the end of it all. And we've got certain skill set and talents and... It would be somehow beneficial for us to sort of to say, okay, how do we best put our skill set and how do we use it to advance our country and build it? But it has to take a collective. It shouldn't be a project of a certain group of people. It shouldn't be, oh yeah, white people, you just give us back the land and everything will be fine. And that's it, you know? So all of us have to contribute to the building of rebuilding South Africa. And I think between 1994 and now, you know, I don't know. I don't see much fruits from sort of the efforts that have been in place. But I think if we rolled up our sleeve as black and white people in South Africa and figured it a way and to work and build South Africa up, yeah.
And look, I think the Zuma years is a big reason why we're not seeing the growth that we should be seeing.
Correct.
Because billions and billions and billions were diverted to someone else. And I think I speak to a lot of people, and a lot of people feel really strongly about this place and are proud to be South African and would love this place to be. We all see the potential here.
Yeah.
There's huge potential, and South Africans are amazing.
But you need a leadership that will rally people, that will unite people, but they'll also motivate people to make a difference. You know, in countries, I'll keep mentioning Malawi, I think I was really, really impressed.
But they're one of the poorest countries in the world.
I know. But you find that, like, from like a poor person in a rural community there, not sort of being discouraged, but thinking, how can I do better for my family? What is it that I can produce, at least so that we are sustainable? What can we eat? So in South Africa, it's sort of different. People say, what can government do for us? Even our entrepreneurs, they think like that. Yeah, government must do this for us. Government must do this. And in different parts of the continent, that conversation is not happening, and entrepreneurs are thriving. Right, it's your business. You've taken the risk. You start a business. That's what it is. Government, yes, usually plays a role by creating an environment, an enabling environment for you to thrive. But in South Africa, government, I must say, from a business point of view, it has supported small business from different programs. But I find in South Africa, there is that culture that government should do this for us. But in Malawi, I found is, okay, what is it that I can do for my family? You know, using my skill set and the land I have, my backyard. People in South Africa, for instance, are not farming, but people are saying they're hungry. But they've got plots and backyard. You can start producing something just for you to eat so that you're not hungry. And you're at least not like a poor, poor person. And you can sell maybe to a few neighbors and things like that. But we don't think like that. A few people actually think like that. Let me not make a mistake. We don't think like that. A few people think like that. And I think we need a government that will encourage people to take action, encourage people to sort of take an initiative and to step up. Yeah.
It was something I was struck by. I was last in the I still call it the Transkei, 2 years ago. There were hardly any veggie gardens that I saw driving along. There were, most houses had rain tanks, I think government provided. But I hardly saw anyone actually growing things on the land, which surprised me. It's like you can feed yourself through.
I don't know what is sort of, I suppose people are not attracted to agriculture, but I think people shouldn't look at it as agriculture. It's just is a way of what should I do? I mean, people shouldn't even be buying baby food, for instance, in the rural communities. If people have fruits and vegetables around, maybe we can say, okay, if you're getting a grant, maybe let's see, can we not sort of get something that will enable you to process the fruit and the vegetables to make baby food, right? So you don't have to like buy everything. People want to go to the retailers and buy chickens and do that, but people don't want to raise, you know, they want to have sort of farm chickens or just have them for their own sustenance. So I think that's something that we need. We need leadership to encourage people to sort of step up and take initiative for at least their own livelihood, so that at least we can try and reduce some of the burdens that we put on our government. I think for me as well, I mean, I've received quite a number of support in my business through government, some competitions I've won, and I find that, you know what, I think for me as a business, I have a pressure and a responsibility taking some of the taxpayers' money and being able to put in my business through these competitions that I've won through government, is to, let me create jobs, let me contribute to the GDP so that I'm not a burden to the government all the time. So when I'm in the position to say, okay, support other entrepreneurs and let me, you know, contribute to that development of our country through creating jobs and
So as you progress, you turn backwards and you bring others with you.
I think that's important.
So tell me about your business. What is it that you're doing?
So we're a Pan-African brand. We mainly work with various agro businesses across the continent and farmers, small-scale farmers. We source various grains, superfoods, products that are indigenous to the African continent, but also have been naturalized. By naturalized, I mean things that easily grow, and although they're not indigenous, but they are. So if we source them from communities, it will really empower them, but also they've been, like cassava and moringa, for instance. Things
are
like
they those. Not... Are they not indigenous to Africa?
No, I think cassava is indigenous to Brazil. Okay. And moringa is indigenous to India. Okay. So, but we grow it and it does well.
Yes.
I mean, Benin, Senegal, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Malawi, we sort of all have moringa and it does really well. So that's something that obviously would sort of enable us to thrive. And people in these regions obviously also use moringa, but also there's a potential for a market sort of outside of the continent in that sense, who sort of need these ingredients, but they grow well in Africa. So that's what we essentially do. We source these various products, we add value, and we also just in the position now as a business where we're trying to actually create more products using some of these inputs we get from communities, so that at least the, you know, it's not just one order of a dried good, but we can, you know, create other things that we can order more, so that people in these communities across the continent can at least have some sort of a supplier. Because this sort of, for us, it's not just, oh yeah, we're supporting farmers, you know, it's not like that. We partner with them, they are suppliers, just like I've been working with an importer, and you know, so we view them as our partners in our business.
Okay. And so are you looking at creating like end user products?
Yeah, food products.
Food products.
Yeah.
Okay.
Food products.
For the South African audience or
so
global audience?
Currently, obviously, it's for South Africa. And with these, the range that we have, we're hoping to go into the European market.
Are you
market.
Allowed to tell me about it? Was it a secret? Is it
What's
still
that?
your products? Are they?
No, it's not a secret. So we do have grain. I mean, gluten-free grain, like for instance, that is indigenous to, I don't know if you've been to an Ethiopian restaurant.
Those big bread things.
So
yes.
That grain that makes, we grow it here in South Africa. We feed it horse feed actually. And but it's also a future food, drought resistant, and it's quite great. It makes a beautiful gluten-free vegan porridge, the grain. And then once it's ground, you can make that fermented bread that the Ethiopians have. You can make cakes, you can make waffles and pancakes.
Okay.
So it's to sort of find ways of actually adding value to some of these products that we actually grow and are indigenous to us, but also just that promoting what is African, because I see that globally in the global banquet table, we don't have African food represented. So we're hoping that as a brand, we'll be able to do that. And so that sort of teach people as well how they can put these ingredients into their day-to-day diets. So if I'm having a smoothie, I could just throw in some moringa in. I can throw in, I don't know, whatever people would want to add, something that's in the continent. Or if I'm doing a waffle, I don't need to only just use almond milk, but I could include the cassava flour, for instance. I can include teff flour or plantain flour that's indigenous to West Africa. So these are some of our, obviously, our products. And yeah. So yes, currently we are in South Africa, just a few health stores. We're hoping to launch into the more traditional retailers by end of 2019. And probably in the next 3 to 5 years, our strategy is to move outside of South Africa and get into some of the parts of the continent as well. And then hopefully outside of the continent. Yeah.
I think it's been spoken of a few times is how... So we're a net importer as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And that costs us as a country, and it costs us as the consumers of this country, especially when our currency is devaluing.
Correct.
So more products from here that are being exported is good for everybody, and it should be a focus of everybody, I think.
Correct.
Because also, you know, so say Pick and Pay stocks your products,
yep.
Local people then become those customers, but you're creating jobs within this ecosystem which enables people to go to Pick and Pay to shop. So it kind of feeds the whole system.
Correct. But I find that a lot in South Africa, I suppose maybe because there's not much of an availability, perhaps I can be really unfair sometimes, but I think that I find that a lot of people love international brands more than local brands, and they tend to be more loyal to international brands. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I like to see it as like we've been colonialized in our minds.
Correct.
By the global brands.
Correct.
Whether it's Nike or a food brand like McDonald's or whatever it is.
Yeah, no. So a lot of people really find sort of value there. They trust the brand more. But sometimes, though, it's more expensive, the products we make locally, than the ones that are not South African.
So they're made in China.
Yeah. Of course. And obviously our labor is expensive. Well, it's not really expensive, but our just trading rentals and factories and that sort of stuff. In comparison to other places, though, minimum wage in South Africa is a bit higher, but it's not like it's a bigger amount. I mean, if it's 3,500, it's not a lot of money for a person to live in because things are expensive in South Africa.
I don't know how someone lives off 3,500 rand anyway.
But it is sort of higher than other places where they manufacture, like China, for instance. So it will be cheaper. Yeah.
So how do you, is it a struggle to get your products out there and on the shelf and getting people to trust local brands?
No, well, for us, I mean, we've been in business for 3 years and we've just been selling at local markets and just testing and been bootstrapping throughout. So we've not really like launched into retail. Now we just got our branding sort of packaging and everything ready and sort of compliant as well. So now that's why we sort of engaging then retailers. So I'll be able to answer you maybe in the next 6 months.
Okay.
Or so, yeah.
So it's an exciting times.
It is.
No, you're about to birth your child.
It is.
Again.
It is, yeah.
And so how long has your husband been away for?
No. He's full-time in South Africa, but he travels every month. So he'll be there for a week attending class, and then he's back. And
So does he support you? Are you?
No, he
does. He work with you in the business? Does he do his own thing?
He consults and he also works for a corporate as well. He works for, but he's very supportive. I think, I don't know how much of his money I've put in the business, and he needs shame to get some rewards, like from equity point of view or something, like returns, because he's put in a lot of money in the business. And also just said, you know, go do your thing and I'll be there. I'll support you right through and through. Yeah.
And have you got external investment as well?
We are in the process. So we've gotten some money from various corporates and competitions we've won through pitching and competitions we've entered for. So, I mean, obviously one has raised even above like 500,000 rand on pitching and so that, you know, and enterprise development programs. So we are in the process now of getting off. Nothing is confirmed yet, but we're talking to quite a lot of interested investors. So weighing, seeing what's the best and who's the best partner and things like that, so that we are able to scale.
And how big is your company? How many employees are there?
So directly, we're a small company. So directly, we've got two and we're doing contract packing. So our contract manufacturer has more people at this point. I think once the investment comes, then we're going to scale up to about between 7 to 13 employees. We are going to still obviously be a lean team because most of our manufacturing at this point is sort of outsourced to various other companies. So there's that direct, indirect impact from a jobs point of view. But yeah.
I think that's the modern way as well. The lean teams and outsourcing and getting other people who specialize in things. I mean, that's the way I run my business as well is... It's very lean.
Yeah,
no, especially in this climate, because we are in a difficult climate here.
And you don't want to take people on board. I mean, it would be great for us to have like 30 employees and stuff, but you don't want to take people on board and your profits can't justify why you should have them on board, or your size as a business from a market share and you know, returns can't justify why you should have them at this point. So I think it's also just important to be able to afford the people, because you don't want to, at the end of the month, you can't pay your people, but they've been there, they've been working because you're not sustainable as a business. So that's important to be in that position. If you are targeting, it's just like, I'm going to create 30 jobs, but how are you going to pay for those people? Yeah, that's important.
And so the products you source, they're from all over Africa. What percentage would you say is South African versus outside of South Africa?
So South Africa, I would say maybe about 40%. Okay. There's products that are indigenous to like Ethiopia, but we farm them in South Africa, like teff, for instance. So South Africa is just our current supply. But it's indigenous to Ethiopia. So you find a bit of market with Ethiopian community and people who maybe are sort of curious about it and want to add it into their diet. But people who would know it are mostly people who obviously grew up eating it, which is mostly Ethiopian people.
I mean, I've come across it in the health, a lot of the health stores and things are starting to, where did I first have it? Oh, there was a guy here, a local guy named James. He had a restaurant called Sexy Foods and he would have wraps with teff wraps.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
that sounds nice.
He's closed it down now, but there's so many innovative products that we don't even know about. I mean, I never even heard of it before that.
Yeah. But there's a nice report, obviously, by I've seen some of the products that we actually do are in that list, where WWF has partnered with Unilever, I think, where they've just produced like 50 future crops. Obviously, that's good for the environment, that is drought resistant, and, you know, that grow well in various parts and be able to feed the, obviously, the expected population growth. So teff is one of them, and moringa is one of them, and various other other grain. There's a grain we're bringing in, we'll be launching it before the end of the year, from Senegal, indigenous to Senegal, well, West Africa rather, because in Nigeria as well it's eaten, it's called something else there. So we're looking forward to that. It's probably going to be competing with quinoa. Very lovely, lovely grain.
Okay, so it's the same application as quinoa, where you boil it and like a replacement for rice or whatever it is.
It's quick. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's gluten free.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Because that's a I'm as gluten free as I possibly can, and it's a growing.
It is.
Trend, if you want to call it, but
yeah, I think it's more a trend than allergy these days. But yeah, it is. It's important to
I saw a post this morning saying you're not gluten intolerant, you're glyphosate intolerant. which is it's a big question. Are all of the farmers that you engage with, are they farming organically?
So I mean, mostly. I mean, really, like, so the small scale farmers, they are, I mean, this is just like, I'm a grower, I've been doing this, so they don't put chemicals, they don't put this, but there's, we're trying to be in a position, obviously we're a small business, to get them to get actually the paperwork. So we're going to be engaging people like Ecoset and that sort of stuff, ask them for their standards, so that they can implement them, so that they can get the actual paperwork. But because of this the size, it's just difficult to pay for that certification. But it's just natural way. Even the sort of bigger ones, there's no GMO, there's no more natural ways of
I guess Monsanto hasn't bought the teff seeds and patented them yet. I think you know, on the more hopeful side, we have more ability to innovate here and do things differently to other places in the world.
No, we do. I didn't ask you though, how are you feeling about the country?
Good question. I have days. Some days I feel great and hopeful, and some days I feel despondent and depressed. So it depends.
Which days are more?
Lately it's been more depressed, I will admit. But I've been reading too much on social media. I think that's part of the problem. I think engaging with people like yourself makes me feel better, because it feels like there are other people who are pushing forward, people who want things to be better, people who are who believe in this country.
Yeah.
But time will tell. I don't know. I don't. I mean, it's unfortunate that we even have to have this conversation.
I know. Yeah, but it's important for us to reflect. I think, and then pretending like there's nothing going on, I think it's important for us to discuss what are our fears, what are our thoughts, and what do we think should happen. There's just so much in South Africa that is not sort of said, and the things that we need to, you know, to need to say and help hopefully push government as well to start implementing some of the things as well. Yeah,
I think you're right in that, you know, as a white man in this world, in this country, I have fears around saying the wrong thing. Because if I say the wrong thing, I will get crucified. That's the fear. Whether that's real or not, I don't know. But I hope that I consider myself relatively conscious in the way I behave and the things that I do and the way I conduct myself. But I think a lot of people feel a lot of things and are too scared to say what they really think or really feel, out of fear of persecution or fear of
judged. And
yeah, being judged.
Look, I think I find that it's important for us, black and white in South Africa, to really be honest. because I've seen, you know, when people, when you ask somebody, hey, are you okay? Yeah, yeah, I'm all right. Mm. And they're not okay. Mm. And that's not genuine. Then there's no real relationship.
Yeah.
In order for us to build, I think it's important for us to sort of talk. But I find that sometimes when a person expresses something, then immediately there's an attack not to listen and say, okay, where is this person coming from? So we don't have that grace. It's almost so easy to just put a blanket statement. I mean, I used to, for me, I really struggled, I won't lie. I didn't go to school where it was sort of mixed. I think the first time I interacted with people who were really different, like white people were different from my skin color, was in university. And being able to go to sort of interact, and you assume that every white person is racist. You assume that every white person is not genuine. They don't like black people. And it's an easier thing to make an assumption like that. But the moment then you start connecting and having good relationships with people, it's almost like when you're going to say, oh, white people are just like this. You just think about that good relationship that you have with somebody who's really genuine and is a friend. But I can't make an assumption like that. So there are people who are not racist. There are people who are not whatever things that may come. Because even black people, by the way. So where people hate other people because they look different from them. And so there's no group that should sort of judge one another. But I think what is important is for each and every one of us to be really genuine when we build relationships, and to be patient and be compassionate, but also be very conscious. I find sometimes you go into a place, you make a comment, even if it's just women, African women, I make an example, you think you all sort of similar, you maybe grew up the same way. No, it's not. And so you'll make, and somebody else will be offended. So it's almost sort of, okay, this is not my peep, so I didn't grow up with this person, but I need to be as honest as I can. But also in the way I deliver something, it's to really be as genuine, but also it comes from a right place. It's not for me to destroy, but I'm saying this to contribute to the building of something. So yeah. I suppose it's just, I mean, I think about marriage. I mean, yeah, you love someone, you meet them, and like, you know, then you have to do real life.
Yes.
And you have to do real life, and almost like, okay, we didn't have maybe the same upbringing. This person, this is their priorities. These are not my priorities. But how do we meet each other halfway so that we can have a more stronger marriage, a more lasting relationship, and we can both enjoy ourselves in this marriage so that, you know, we're not frustrating each other. So it's almost, you know, if in order for us to build, we need to say, okay, where do I need to sort of compromise? Where do you need to compromise? How do we meet each other? But if none of us are willing to do that, there's no way that we're going to be stronger. There's no way we are going to be standing as a society. Mm. Yeah.
Couldn't agree more. I think you spot on there. And I think a lot of what's gone on in the more public space has been divisive,
where
it's an us and them.
Yeah.
They're wrong. We're right. Yeah. Blaming white monopoly capital, things like that.
I'd like to actually check maybe people like the definition of that. Just go and just do, just like, what does this mean? And I'd be surprised. I think we'll be surprised to hear some of the responses about actually, what do people actually think it is? But yeah, I've been hearing a lot of that word going around. Yeah,
yeah. It was created by a PR agency, that term.
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, okay. I remember.
Right.
I remember. Yeah, no, but it's almost, yeah, look, it's sort of different. I mean, I can say, yeah, not every white person is racist. And somebody can say to me, yeah, I'm a sellout. Why do I not defend some of the causes? When sometimes where other people who look like me, speak like me, or, you know, don't do things the, you know, right way, then I don't say it because I'm not going to be viewed as a sellout, or I'm in support of white people. But, you know, justice is a tricky thing, because you have to put yourself aside and do what is right. So whether it makes you look good or not, as long as it's right. And so sometimes you almost don't side with people who look like you, maybe white men or something, on a certain view, but it doesn't mean that, you know, you, whatever sellout means. But yeah, when people say that, you know, you, I found a lot of people, African people in South Africa, have been called that when they are wanting to reason sometimes, to say, yeah, but you can't blame a white person for this particular issue. And people like, oh no, you are captured. Yeah, shame, like what they're doing to the current president. Yeah.
He's got a difficult job here.
No, he does.
I don't envy him.
No, he does. He does. There's just so much going on. I think
I believe in him, though. I think he has the right mentality.
Yeah, I think so too. Look, you know, leadership, I mean, people have different perspective, but when I first listened to him, I think when he started with the Tumamina statement in Parliament, when he spoke at the address, I was really hopeful. Like, I mean, I was really, really hopeful. And I said, you know what? I also want to take action. I want to make a difference. And we need a leadership like that, but also a leadership just like Nelson Mandela, a leadership. Yeah, people have their flaws, but a leadership that is able to unite people from all walks of life and everybody feels like I also belong here. We need that. South Africa does not only belong to Black people. South Africa does not only belong to white people. South Africa belongs to all of us. And we need a leadership to inspire everybody who's different to say, I'm going to contribute to a society. And I feel like the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has that ability to sort of rally people. Yeah, I think he does have shortfalls, and like every other human being. But if he's got priorities that are in the right place and he wants everybody to contribute, then I think, I think he should be supported by the nation.
I think he's quite hamstrung by a lot of factors within the government. So it might not be him that he might be the next step in the right direction, but it might not actually be him depending on how long he's in power for.
Oh yeah, because we've got that problem in South Africa as well.
Yeah, I don't know who's next in line. I don't know if you have any idea who's next in line and how that looks, because for me that's more of the concern. Like where are we going after Cyril?
Yeah. Now, Ivan, I mean, I'm not really in terms of like, maybe somebody who would listen to this would think that this one is not politically informed. But this
so just for the record, I'm super politically uninformed.
Me too. But what I've observed and what I think as a South African and sort of an activist, if you'd want to the development of our nation, I'd want to see a leadership like, there's two people that I've heard both these women speak, and I find that there's so much clarity and they don't mix their words, but I think they're able to, because as South Africa, you need to be able to have a leadership that will able to go to Davos and you don't cringe when somebody's there in Davos like, okay, what is this person going to say? Are they going to even represent us? You need a leader that will be able to operate in spaces like that, but also understand some of the problems and challenges we have as a country, not just middle class problems, but issues that happen in the roots of, in our communities. So people need to be able to understand that, but also understand that South Africa is sort of a divided society. I mean, it has a middle class and high class and sort of lower end in terms of income. So a leadership that will be able to understand and have the grace to be able to deal with both, but also understand the global community. I find there's a lady, she's the current minister, I think, of rural development and agriculture, if you want to, Togo Didiza and Phumzile Ncube. I find, I mean, every time I listen to these women, I find so much clarity. They don't mix their words, they're clear, but also they understand, you know, the struggle of South Africa, but also they understand the global community. So it's almost like you want to be able to, because obviously South Africa, we're not a middle class society, so we don't need a president or leader who's just understands that. You need somebody who understands all sort of levels.
My concern, like I hear you on the leadership side, and we definitely need leadership to help us bring us together, but there's also a component of taking your own responsibility things.
No, of course.
Because if we were waiting on them to do everything, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, no, of course. So. I think it's, I mean, we need to do that, like from schools and our communities. Like, there's certain things that we don't have to wait for government to make decisions. I think as we are at the Food Next conference, we're talking about nutrition, right, at schools. I think sometimes as communities, or we need to say, okay, we'll, as a community, we'll do a community garden. We're not going to have children who don't go to bed hungry. I mean, we're not going to have children going to bed hungry. We're going to use this veg garden, but also we're not going to give children junk food. We're going to ensure that our children, eat healthy food, healthy snacks. So those are choices that we can meet. We don't have to wait for government to do everything, but that's where we can meet them halfway at least. And so we all have that responsibility, right?
I've run out of questions. What would you, if you had to challenge anyone listening or the population of South Africa to anything, what would your challenge be? What would you ask of them?
It's going to sound a bit philosophical, but I think, or fluffy, but I think that let us deal with each other as people with love at the center of our hearts. when I say love, sort of grace and patience and kindness, I think that should be the core of whatever we do. Mm. When we're at work, the contribution we make in our teams, let that be, you know, the core. We're there, whether you like it or not, you're working in somebody's company, you're getting a salary, the benefits, give your best in that organization. Whether you're running a business, give your best, you know, don't give us mediocre products. I hope, I'm putting myself under pressure, but let's like be excellent in everything that we do. But also as we interact with each other, let us be gracious and be kind to each other and contribute to the building of our society. Yeah.
I don't want to add anything to that. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. It's great to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you.
You've been listening to SeedPod with me, Lee Rail. Thank you so much for your attention. I know that it's not always easy to listen to a conversation that's an hour or more these days with time being so pressed. So I really appreciate those who are listening to these conversations, and I hope you're getting as much value out of it as I am. I'm walking away with nuggets of wisdom from each conversation, and I trust that you are as well. You might have noticed that there's a little bit more noise in the backgrounds of the recordings. That's because I'm not in a studio anymore. I have gone on my own. I've got a mobile setup. And so I'm doing it all myself. I'm recording myself. I'm editing myself. And so if there's any feedback, if it's too loud, too soft, too noisy, let me know. If you have any feedback as to the content of the podcast, love to hear from you. Otherwise, keep listening, keep sharing, and keep being inspired.